Well, I guess we can get started now. We're going to be talking about a couple of books, most of which you're familiar with, The Trouble with Physics by Lee Smolin, and another one that I don't have a physical copy of here called Not Even Wrong by Peter Woyd, after that wonderful quote from Wolfgang Pauli about a theory being so bad it's not even wrong. When I was having a conversation about these books this week with one of the physicists here, I found myself referring to it as Wolin and Smoit. So these have kind of become smashed together in all of our minds, I think, although they're very different books. And in particular, I just wanted to talk about the media reaction to the books and maybe be able to give you some insight to why things are played the way they are and how this ties into somewhat to the culture of journalism, which, like anything else, has its own.
I'm joining them together and calling it Swollen.
Swollen. Okay. One thing I mentioned in my email introducing the talk was how the blogosphere has come to act as a kind of echo chamber for all of this, so that someone says something or it appears in the paper and then it's amplified by one blog, and then this blog blogs that blog, and you get this huge web of commentary that actually all kind of boils down from one source, maybe. So, you know, it's sometimes like you hear something twice and then three times and you think it has to be true because it's coming from three different places, and yet they're all just echoes from the same source. So,
string theory.
Yeah, so this is Peter Woyd's blog here, and this morning I was looking at it just to see if I could find an example of this to use in my talk, and I was scrolling down and found an entry here called The String Wars, and I thought, you know, that's familiar. You know, Steve Schenker and Amanda and I think, just kind of came up with this title for an imaginary blog that someone might start, you know, giving less critical information about string theory. So I was surprised to see The String Wars, and then I saw, you know, so this is how it's gotten. You know, I'm here, you know, in this obscure position as a journalist at residence at Kavli, and this thing goes out on the email to, you know, people who might come to the talk, and it's already blogged by Peter Woyd, and, you know, someone will probably blog his blog, so. I find the whole thing rather remarkable. Yeah. One thing that I think might help put this into perspective is to think of other. I'm trying to think of other subjects that I've covered as a journalist that have kind of gone through this, you know, this up and down roller coaster ride, where first we're all writing stories about, you know, the wonderful new promise of the field, and then we're all, you know, seem to be writing stories that are a backlash, or perceived as a backlash. And the first thing I can really think of when I really first started doing this was artificial intelligence. And this was in the 1980s. And I had recently read Douglas Hofstadter's book, Gödel, Escher, Bach, which is one of my all-time favorites. And I really wanted to have a chance to meet Douglas Hofstadter. So, you know, as a journalist, the nice thing about it is you can say, well, I really need to do a profile of Hofstadter, and maybe you can send me to Bloomington, Indiana. So I did that, and it ended up being part of a three-part series I did for a paper in Minneapolis, the Minneapolis Star, on artificial intelligence. And I ended up writing more about it and ended up doing a popularized book called Machinery of the Mind. And this was really the heyday of, you know, AI in the 80s and all these startup companies in Silicon Valley, and like with names like Technology and like two or three competing hardware companies making Lisp machines. And and then the AI conferences were really lavishly funded and had really good refreshments and good parties. And then, like, 5 years later, you start noticing people are talking about an AI winter, and people, you know, the same, you know, well, it was promised that they were going to, you know, have a brain in a box or an artificial consciousness, and now here we are with nothing to show for it. And then, of course, all the stories in the press were about AI has failed to live up to its promise. And it's, you know, it struck me as kind of a similar little structure to the flow. And another thing where that happened was, let's see, What was the other thing? I had another one besides string theory that I was mulling over this morning.
High temperature superconductivity.
Okay, yeah. Perfect. High temperature superconductivity. I think the first story that James Gleick wrote when he was still a reporter at the New York Times on the, it was like a big conference on high temperature superconductivity, and he described it to Woodstock, you know, just with the excitement and the enthusiasm of the crowd. And then later it was, you know, well, where are all these super conductive long distance power lines and things? And of course, meanwhile, superconductivity research is doing, you know, just fine and then continuing on. But you know, to read the stories of something like this, it kind of imposes this artificial boom and bust cycle, and just trying to think why that happens. And I think part of it is just, I mean, the nature of journalism is that, you know, we think in terms of stories, in somewhat in the way that you probably think in terms of models and theories when you look at the universe, and it's always the story. So if I want to write something for the Times or another publication, just because I think it sounds really cool, which is true with a lot of these physics things, the first thing my editor will ask me is, well, what's the story here? And, you know, it's got to be a narrative. This is what people want to read. So the story in 1995, which is the, I think the first time I wrote about superstring theory for the Times was, see, that's actually a different one. Nice picture of Lisa Randall there.
Raman.
Let's see. Well, I'll use this one. This isn't actually the first one. This is one, actually, Peter White footnoted this as an example. The headline is an example of overblown hype coverage saying how great superstring theory was. And, you know, and it's, you know, the headline bugged me too, and I read it the next day in the paper. And we don't write our own headlines, just so you know. And sometimes, yeah, it's another one of those journalistic culture things. But, you know, the story, you know, doesn't say that at all. I mean, actually, what it says is, you know, there's a structure to these stories. You start out with what we call the lead, which for obscure journalistic history reasons is spelled L-E-D-E, and in case you're interested in why, it's back from the days of lead typesetting, you know, linotype machines, and they thought the printers might confuse it and think you were talking about lead, the element, and which seems kind of, you know, ridiculous. But, you know, there's also things like if you're writing a story and there's still a part still to come to send to the editor, they put TK for to come. And I can't remember what the justification of that was. It's
like, okay.
Yeah, I mean, you know, journalism started out, you know, the old days in Chicago and, you know, the my first job was covering the police beat for the Albuquerque Journal. So, but a story like this was probably, what, 96, 7, something like that, all the way up to 2000. And I had another one here that was a better example. Let's see. Oh, this one. Another one of these great headlines that we don't write. Almost in awe, physicists ponder the ultimate theory. So, 98. And it's really, this is, I think, the first time the Times had written a story referring to something called M theory. So I kind of used that as my entree, and then just describing this meeting. And, you know, this was the one when the Maldacena conjecture just recently come out, and everyone was talking about that. And Dennis Overby, who was then the deputy editor at Science Times, asked me to, you know, write something about what's going on with superstrings. And I'd written about it before, you know, years and years ago. It was a chance for me to catch up on it. It was before all the things with D-brains, and, you know, it was just like a whole new thing to write about. So, and, you know, this is the one where, and then the structure. You have your lead, and, yes. I remember Corey Dean, who was the science editor, tried to talk me out of that first sentence, and now I think she was right. It's kind of dumb. But when many science fans tuned in, physicists and such, you know, so, and, you know, this is basically a story saying that there's been this big revival of the field and a new revolution and all the stuff about M theory, and then just to make you know, and then once you have your lead and you're kind of, you know, saying what the story's about, and the lead is generally followed by what we call in the profession the significance paragraphs, or sometimes they're called the nut graphs because they tell the nut of the story. And if you look at almost any story in the newspaper, whether it's about string theory or a murder or a new tax bond issue, there'll be the lead and then there'll be the significance paragraphs. It's kind of telling you why you, the reader, are reading this now, why this is a story, and why you should forge on. And then you'll kind of hint at some points that you're going to make later without, you know, you don't want to give away your punchlines, but just to kind of give a sense of what's to follow. And so that's what comes next. And then you kind of actually get into the actual, you get into the actual story. And this was great because it was that meeting where,
oh, that was,
you know, with the, you know, do the Maldacena. And so it was fun to be able to, you know, play with that idea. And then we decided to do a sidebar where Thinking Man's Macarena is the headline. And I talked to Jeffrey Harvey, and he helped me. These were superscripts, these numbers at the end of each line in the printed edition. So you know, we basically went through and we annotated it, and you know, just explained what, you know, what this esoterica meant, so the common reader could kind of get a sense. And and then, you know, I think there was even, you know, we call that a sidebar. And then there's some, you know, the whole thing is probably 2,500 words, which is pretty long. And you know, nowadays it's really hard to get the Times to agree to anything more than maybe 2,000 for something they really think is good. So so this was, you know, part of the, you know, the kind of stuff that the what was the word for, you know, white and swollen combined together?
Swollen.
That the Swollen books, not Lee's book, but that White's book uses examples of how the media had really, you know, been very gullible, and his interpretation of the backlash, if there's indeed a backlash, you know, other than, you know, the fact that he put up the website and wrote the book, is that you know, now journalists are feeling burned because, you know, they were promised all of these wonderful, you know, the reconciliation of quantum mechanics and general relativity, and now they feel disappointed and they're lashing back. And you know, I don't.
I mean, the significance of the Sturm and Jabber calculation.
But I think it's much easier to understand just in terms of, you know, just storytelling and the fact that people want a story. And the story before was superstring theory, maybe on the verge. And you know, the way you structure these stories too, you have the lead in which you make all these promises, you know. You know, when you think, you know, this is great, superstring theory may finally reconcile the two pillars of physics. And then you kind of take, you know, there's what my colleague John Noble Wilford calls the to be sure paragraphs. And to be sure, you know, many physicists say that this could be a long ways off and that, you know, huge obstacles lie ahead. However, and then you go back. So you start by, I heard someone else describe it as, you start by giving all this stuff out, and then you start taking it back a little bit to get to a more even keel, and then get on with the story. So now the story, as far as the journalists are concerned, is, you know, we see these two books coming out by very smart people that are questioning the wisdom of putting at least as much resources into superstring theory as are being put there, and one's by you know, Lee Smolin, who's, you know, a physicist himself, one's by a mathematician. And just the fact that two books come out at the same time, of course, again, amplifies this notion that, that, you know, there's really, you know, something there that the media should pay attention to. And, of course, you don't know if that's, I mean, sometimes these things are a coincidence, but it could be, you know, a reasonable signal.
I just wanted to ask a very brief question. Why is it that media persons or some interpretation is out there that somehow maybe string theory was overblown.
Yeah.
People feel like the media didn't perhaps accurately report what was happening, or there was some miscommunication somehow. But then the assumption of Smolin and Voigt is that the media all of a sudden is reporting what they say accurately.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so the disease that occurred to
people in the
past is, of course, not Smolin.
Well, yeah, and if you look at the stories, the way they were in 1995 was, here's this wonderful stuff about superstring theory, and to be sure, we are a long ways off. And now the stories are, there's this backlash against superstring theory, and after years of promises, some people are saying it's not paying off. And then you'll have the to be sure paragraph. It says, to be sure, most superstring theorists, feel that this is the most promising place to put their bets, and there have been, wonderful, spin-offs into mathematics and things. So you actually have, what's on balance, an even story, and yet the focus is different.
Is part of the problem that journalists, maybe the larger field of journalism, is more interested in the sociology of science than in the actual science itself?
Yeah, probably. I mean, most, there's a sense in which we probably tend to think of it as if we were covering politics or something, and of course it's human nature that every field has certain strong personalities that tend to get a lot of attention, while the people that are kind of doing more of the day-to-day work do not. I mean, we worry about that when we do these things and try to have correctives, but I think it's just human nature that just as you think of the world in terms of stories, there's going to be heroes and villains, and it imposes a structure that, like all structures, are imposed and artificial. It's kind of a way to, I guess the question is whether if that kind of structure and storytelling brings in a lot of readers who would read about superstring theory that otherwise would know or have it would just be completely alien to them. That's probably not a bad thing if the stories are done correctly. So if you have a story saying that there is a backlash, however big or small it is, that indeed it exists, and then there's a lot of people though that don't think this is something to worry about. So it gives you a chance to again tell people what string theory is and what some of the long-standing problems are and some of the basic dilemmas. So but it's just kind of, it's cast in this narrative form.
The question I have is that the media loves to build up and destroy, which is part of the sociology.
Well, yeah, it's not that we love to do that, but, it's just what happens because of the nature of the beast.
Sports politics, doesn't matter, it's always the same. It's a spectacle.
Well, it's a story when it's going up, and it's a story when it's coming down.
Exactly. Yeah.
Everybody wins on the media side, everyone loses on the air side. But the question really for you is that if you place yourself back 50 years and another 50 years before that, you could write a very interesting story about 50 years ago, antiprotons had just been discovered, if you think that's right. And, we now had a decent theory. We had quantum mechanics, we had relativity, we had general relativity. We saw that there's antimatter, it looks like symmetry. It's like everything's in place. You got 50 years before that, we see that the light has a compression of properties, we have photons, relativity has just been discovered, Maxwell's equations look good, everything looks like it's in order, finally. Okay, it's a few flies in the ointment, but that'll be sorted out later. Then you go 50 years beyond that, you kind of wake your way back, and at every point you say, aha, the solution's just around the corner.
Yeah,
we understand
right.
Everything, we can finally get ready to close the path off.
Yeah.
Okay, and that's where we are today.
Yeah, and you could go back.
How you may be in the same place.
Yeah, it'd be an interesting exercise to go back to like 1930 or something and do some newspaper stories on what was on the verge of being discovered and the ups and downs and I think one way to think of it is what we do as journalists is kind of a rough draft of history, and it gets revised with every story you do. And but there's a lot more coverage. I mean, I don't think, back in the real early heyday of quantum mechanics, I doubt the New York Times was running, many stories about Heisenberg, and whether Heisenberg and Schrodinger's competing interpretations, and then suddenly the reconciliation. And it'd be interesting to go back and look. I mean, of course, they did have stories. They had a story about Einstein's special relativity that had this famous headline about lights all askew in the heavens or something like this, and had all these different decks like the headlines used to have. And so they did cover this stuff, but I don't think as intensely or as closely as we probably do now. But yeah, rough draft of history that's always getting revised. And
yeah. I mean, if you go back to the time of the discovery of radioactive elements, there were big headlines in the New York Times saying that here's a new source of energy, it's going to power ships that travel millions of miles on a small amount of material.
Yeah.
And then there's the next vision in the public's eye is a mushroom cloud. And now, still today, nobody knows anything about what radioactivity is.
Yeah.
Not a clue.
Yeah.
So the media just takes them from one extreme to another extreme and never explains anything in between, never gives them any details.
Yeah. Well, I think we do, but we've had plenty of stories that explain a lot, whole little charts about radioactivity and things. But if you take the media as a whole, including every newspaper in the country, that's probably true.
So I guess I'm a little confused about something. I mean, science books come out all the time.
Yeah.
There's this nice book by Lisa Randall a year ago or so.
Yeah.
And they usually get reviewed here and there, but mm-hmm. they don't generate the sort of number of stories that these two books seem to have generated. Now, I gather from what you said that the explanation is that this is now, quote, a story, that mm-hmm. somehow people have been building up string theory. And But there are books coming out all the time which have even bigger stories. Mm-hmm. Einstein is wrong, general relativity is mm-hmm. a mistake. And if that were true, it would be a really big story.
Yeah, that's true that didn't get picked up.
Journalists don't pick up on that and write.
Yeah, although a counterexample on string theory, Brian Greene's book obviously is, I think it sold a million copies in hardcover, which is just astonishing. And he was, he was on the cover of New York Magazine. He was on Charlie Rose.
This may be crackpots. That's what he's saying.
I'm sorry?
saying this books may be written by crackpots. That's what he's saying.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't think.
Journalists are picking up on this without sort of questioning it.
Yeah. I don't think anyone would call Lee Smolin a crackpot.
You want to take a vote on that?
I'd actually like to amplify Gary's point.
Yeah.
I think that what bothers me the most about the Smolin and Boyd talks is that they're sort of hypocritical. They don't actually apply the same standard of criticism to their own discipline.
Yeah.
I mean, for example, the quantum gravity has a far worse landscape.
Yeah, but I think you told me that you hadn't read Smolin's book, and he actually, I think, does point out in quite some detail the problems with all the other different approaches. And yeah, I wonder. Did you? Did your person to your left? Did you read the books?
Me?
Yeah.
No.
Okay.
We had discussions with Lee over a period of at least a decade.
Yeah.
I'd say I've talked to him.
Yeah, no, you probably know
dozens
him.
Dozens and dozens of hours. Bit.
Yeah.
And.
Yeah, and.
I think what bothers me is that people in the media are reading these books.
Yeah.
And thinking that what's in them is true—it's a mistake.
The reviews.
There's a lot of inaccuracy.
Yeah.
C. Cole picked up on it.
Yeah.
Tom Siegfried. Had some real, quite incisive and cutting criticisms of inaccuracies in both books.
Yeah.
So, even though a person wears the colors of I'm an academic, I'm a professor at the Perimeter Institute.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that what they write in a popular book is correct.
No, I think you should probably read at least one of the books because they're not really the diatribes that they come off seeming like, I don't think. And I mean, Voigt's book is, the first part of it is this extremely technical discussion that I could certainly not follow, and then kind of toward the end, and I don't know. I think I don't have the objective knowledge of string theory by which I can say what's right or wrong, but to me, Lee's book particularly struck me as a cogent criticism. And this might be a good time to, I mentioned before I gave this talk, maybe we could get Lee on on a video monitor to join us, but I didn't really try to do that. But instead, he'd just been corresponding with Jim Hartle, and Jim forwarded me some comments Lee made, and Lee gave us permission to use them. So why not? This is the first. So you can at least see the, since we don't have Lee here to defend his book. So basically saying that he's really just trying,
Why does he believe that? In the public arena?
Why do you believe that?
Yeah. Why do I believe that?
Yeah. It's obviously not true if you look at the book in the bookstore, for example.
Yeah, but if you read the book, it didn't strike me.
He's saying it's a normal discussion within scientific community.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not. It's a public arena, right?
Yeah.
So it's not normal scientific discussion.
When Burton Richter compares string theory to theology, or Phil Anderson, or this is not the public. I mean, no one in the public cares about string theory one way or the other. They think it's fascinating, and so I don't mean they don't care about it in that regard, and they're fascinated by the thought that there could be this theory of everything, and they're fascinated by the ideas of extra dimensions, and most smart people love to learn things, but they don't have any axe to grind whether this is the right theory or not. So I don't really think, I think the media is echoing a debate that may be not raging within the string theory community, but I sure know many physicists who do, share some of these opinions. So I don't think you can say it's artificial.
Could you distinguish statistically, though, between the outliers of a distribution and where the core of the distribution sits?
Yeah.
If you take any topic about which any set of humans care, whether it's string theory, American politics, name your subject, then you'll be able to find some people with rather extreme opinions about what's going on.
Yeah.
So what I think is odd is that people that you just quoted don't really represent the what's centrally going on in the scholarly community.
Yeah.
Like Phil Anderson has been a trenchant critic of Heinrich.
Well, yeah, of course.
Energy theory, not only string theory, but also particle theory as well.
No, I mean, there's all the sociology, too. I mean, the condensed matter versus particle physicist. And, Phil's getting back, as Murray Gell-Mann called his field, squalid state physics. And, so I mean, there's so many factors here. And, of course, the media echo chamber is one of them, and the blogosphere echo chamber echoing the media echo chamber, but a lot of these blogs are written by very, very good responsible scientists like Sean Carroll and Clifford Johnson. So it's and there's more on their blogs about this whole thing than there probably has been at all in the popular press. So there you're having the debate amplified by people who are working in or at least on the edge of the field. So I think it's more complicated than just saying it's media hype. And I went looked at some of the stories that appeared. Oh, actually, I had a
scroll up on that one.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, this. Yeah. Okay. Right there?
No.
Further? Oh, I didn't get to the end of that. Wait, let me. Oh, I see. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, a little more. Oh, it just keeps going and going. Yeah, okay. I'll pause for a moment.
Speak at a strengths conference?
I don't know. Yeah, I wouldn't.
Can someone say what background independent means? I'm not sure.
It means not choosing an a priori background metric.
Okay.
So, I mean, the origin of this criticism goes back 20 years. When string theory started, it was a perturbative theory, and you had to sort of pick a space-time to start with, and then the strings represented small fluctuations about it. And the approach that Lee was working on at the time, the so-called loop quantum gravity, set up to be independent of any a priori space-time. So since then, certainly in the sort of mid-90s, we learned how to do string theory keeping only an asymptotic metric. Basically, a boundary condition and affinity we had to pick, but the metric inside was allowed to fluctuate. So that was a big step toward background independence. But you know, we don't have one formulation of string theory which is independent of any boundary conditions at infinity. Okay. And so I think everybody in the field agrees that's a big important
open. This is a good example. I really, this is one of the reasons some of us find at least small room somewhat, I wouldn't want to say dishonest, but cluster. And in this particular issue of background independence, in a public talk he gave at the Pope's birthday celebration, or a public talk at Franklin, he again raised this issue, string theory is background dependent. And he was pressed by various people in the audience, including me, that we have situations in which we actually have, first time, a well-defined description of general quantum gravity in the vault, no formalism that specifies no background metric at all except insofar as boundary conditions are not. And that in fact, various physical phenomena arise from the contribution of different backgrounds of even different topologies. Something that no other approach to quantum gravity has ever been able to achieve. And that, you know, that. And in fact, he agreed with that. I mean, he was couldn't. He agreed that is indeed the case. We now have a situation where a non-perturbative formulation seems to be dual to quantum gravity in 10 dimensions, specifies no background, all background metric at all. And then he goes on and says this. He says the same. He says that, and then he makes the same statement, which might, you know, have been an accurate description of the initial perturbative treatments. And I find it extremely disturbing that he, you know, will say, play, you know, be double-faced.
Yeah, because that's certainly one of his big points in his book.
When you confront him with this argument, he will say, yeah, well, you're right. That's right. And then go ahead and say exactly the opposite.
No, and I see. I mean, that's clearly a problem because someone like me who's reading these books and reviewing them, in my case for Scientific American, I can't really evaluate an argument like that so much. Although when this has been written about in news stories, you know, there'll be people who can, you know, call up David Gross and ask him, is this really true? And of course, the chance that a news story is going to get into the concept of background independence at all is not too likely, although the Times, you know, might do that, but yeah.
I have a question. I mean, I'm a historian of science with no special interest or knowledge about string theory, and I'm also somewhat of an unconstructed materialist in the sense that if I were to start paying attention to string theory, I would probably be concerned with who funds it, who supports it. And I guess what I'm interested in, having read the New Yorker article or today's op-ed piece and the various popularizations of this article, is there any concern that this debate will upset funding toward doing string theory or upset the recruitment of students into the field, and that perhaps lies at the root of some of the discontent about these books being published?
Yeah. Anyone?
I think it's manifestly obvious that it motivates at least Smolin is upfront about it. He says one of his objections to string theory is that it gets all the good graduate students
and all the smart people get hired.
Are forced by their mean professors.
Oh, that's not quite what he says, but.
And they should be doing other things.
I mean, he talks about the bandwagon effect.
The thing that's two ways about it is that when Lee is trying to cut down string theory, chop us off at the knees, you know, if you know Lee, that it's because he wants our money. I mean, it's because he doesn't have it that he wants to cut.
Yeah, but again, in his book, I mean, he, you know, basically his argument is that more of the alternative approaches should be funded.
How many positions are there available in loop quantum gravity in the world?
Yeah.
Ask yourself this: there's probably a handful of postdocs. I don't know on average how many loop quantum gravity ers are hired every year into faculty positions worldwide, but I would guess it would be less than half a dozen.
I just want to interject something. Bringing up what you feel is the reasonableness of his book, but is and in his comment, which is now covered up, he says, gosh, how is it that I'm perceived as anti-string? The subtitle of the book is The Rise of String Theory and the Fall of Science. How can he, and this is an excellent and less technical example of his two-facedness, say on his notes, gosh, I'm shocked that I'm perceived as And I'm a little surprised, I'd like your comments on that subtitle. Mm. It seems to me that
Yeah, that's a really high. Yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
You did not pick your subtitle.
No, I was going to. Yeah. No, I was going to say. I was going to say that authors, while they may not pick the subtitles, they certainly approve them. So, no, I mean, it's clear. I mean, there's a whole other force you have in all of these is. The book packagers trying to come up with something that's going to fly off the shelves, as they say. And I remember the other example of this kind of boom and bust cycle I was thinking of was complexity theory. And around the early 90s and late 80s and early 90s, when the Santa Fe Institute was just starting to, it was a great story. Here are these people in Santa Fe in an old convent down off Canyon Road, and Murray Gell-Mann and all these people. And then, it was great to, get to go to Santa Fe and interview these people. And, and they tell a really, really good story, just like any good scientist can tell a good story about where their field might go and what it could solve and the intellectual questions it addresses. So there was a lot of media coverage about complexity. And then two books came out the same season called Complexity with slightly different subtitles. But in this case, the subtitles, I don't remember what they were, but they were probably aired on the other side of, making it sound more imminent than it really was. And then again, a few years later, we started, seeing articles basically saying, well, whatever happened to complexity research and why hasn't anything come out of this? So again, that same cycle was followed. I just put, these are the, some of the, well, one of the results of all this is just some really bad puns and headlines and, yeah.
I'd like to make a comment about the way books are marketed.
Mm-hmm.
There's a public relations office that sends press releases out to the media,
yeah.
Their favorite media contacts,
mm-hmm.
and then they actually embellish what's in the book by their press releases. And
yeah.
I have a sense that they were amplifying some of the negative things to make it more attractive for the writers to review the book.
Yeah.
Magazine, and then everyone jumped
up
on the bandwagon.
Yeah, no, that's true. The press releases, they're usually written by, like a 22-year-old Radcliffe graduate who's trying to break into publishing and, is living in Manhattan in a studio apartment with their three best friends, and they're all working at publishing companies, and then you find that this is your book publicist, and she'll be in charge of your publicity campaign, for which they allocated $10,000. I remember there was a press kit that came with Lee Smolin's book, and I'm sure with Peter Woit's book that. I suppose some people pay attention to those. When I review a book, I just throw that stuff away because I don't want it to poison my perceptions. But you get this comes into some places. I imagine they especially for like radio interviews, because the radio interviewers hardly ever read the books, and then they'll just have the suggested Q&As, and then basically it ends up just. Really is an amplifier for the author's agenda and for the publisher's agenda to sell books. So.
One of the things I like so much about Brian Greene's piece today
All right.
New York Times was that he talked about the nature of science itself
and
to understand that people live with uncertainty for long periods of time in the development of theory and experimentation after that.
Yeah.
And perhaps do you have a feeling that the responsibility of science writers to remind the public, our compelling stories through narratives, to remind the public about the nature of science itself, because if we make it too much into infotainment, people are always going to expect a clear cut, well, we made it here, we're 5 year gap here, we've made that science here.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's hard to do that in a newspaper. It's the kind of thing I try to do in my essays sometimes, like in the Week in Review, to give people more of a sense of the process. But again, you can't really do it unless, you know, unless it's part of a story. And, you know, there has to be a frame for it, because that's just the way newspapers and magazines are, I think. And but, you know, there is a tendency, you know, these things, well, like the, you know, medical stories is the example you hear usually about how the way the stories come out, it's always, you know, the great big medical breakthrough. And again, you have the classic structure of the story, you know, the, you know, there'll be the great medical breakthrough that's cured some disease, and then, to be sure, scientists say that, you know, on-the-shelf medications may be decades away, and, you know, this still needs to undergo, you know, many years of FDA trials, and it's possible, too, that this will have all kinds of horrible side effects, but so, you know, same thing. This is the Brian Greene piece, which is also just a complete surprise to me to see today. Good timing, but see, it's on the most emailed list somewhere. Here it's the most, it's the third most emailed story in the New York Times today. So that says something, you know. And it's, I mean, of course, part of that's the Brian Greene has some cachet and. Oh, I see. Sorry. Yeah. So this is, you know, really gives all the really strong arguments for why. One thing he says, how, you know, it's really kind of silly to say that there should be a deadline by which you solve the problems of the universe, and then after that you move on to something else. So he has some good lines in it. He really gives, you know, Brian Greene's a good writer, and he really makes the, you know, all the really strong points and the kind of things I've been hearing from a lot of you during the last 2 weeks, and just puts it all together in a piece that, you know, appears in the op-ed page of the New York Times and is going to be widely read. So, yeah.
He doesn't even mention the two books.
He doesn't mention the books at all, although I suspect that that was part of the motivation for the timing. You know, yeah. If not by Brian Greene himself, maybe the op-ed editor just thinking, well, you know, there's been all this, you know, stuff on string theory and. Didn't this guy, wasn't there some guy from Columbia that wrote a wrote a book on this that was really popular, and we saw him on TV, and but it, yeah, it's a nice piece, and you know, it's certainly getting as much play as any of the things that are kind of tilted the other way. Yes.
I think the greater story here is the interaction between science and the public as voiced through the media, because scientific funding largely came about for the public arena after World War II, not prior. And so scientists are often placed in the position of having to, and I hate to use the term, prostitute themselves to the public to sell their wares, whether, you know, in an equitable manner or not, so as to get support from the public for their wares, whether experimental or theoretical. And I think that the greater danger is that the public comes to expect from the scientists, the same way they expect from the media or from a sports person, for instantaneous results.
Yeah.
And the nature of science, simply in general, is not that.
Right.
And therefore, the public becomes fed up and says, you know, this is all just a bunch of junk, because they're not delivering on what they told us they would deliver, you know, last week.
Yeah, and it feeds a certain current of anti-intellectualism.
Exactly.
It's just always.
I think that's the great danger in all of this, is that, and scientists have to be very careful as to how they discuss things and how they sell their wares to the greater public. May yield a flash in the press in the long term, and they burn them.
Yeah.
Burn everybody around them.
Yeah. But when you take this in the context of all the coverage, I mean, certainly in Science Times on superstring theory and all aspects of physics and science, I mean, it's really, I mean, basically most science writers are cheerleaders for science, and we're just writing about how fascinating all this stuff is and how totally cool it is, and there's nothing I would rather write than a story about some work that has no practical applications whatsoever. And there's always pressure, again, from editors. They say, well, what's the practical applications of superstring theory? You know, and, none. But I think, you know, that's not going to, that probably wouldn't play at your, you know, your small town newspaper, like where I live, the Santa Fe New Mexican, has a science writer whose job is mostly to cover what's going on at Los Alamos, but, you know, anything they write about, they're going to have to, you know, say what the practical applications are. And that's an unfortunate, I mean, you know, the epitome of it was back when William Proxmire was offering, you know, putting up his Golden Fleece awards for science that he didn't understand, and then kind of tapping into this sort of Yahoo populist anti-intellectual element. So it's something, you know, we really do try to guard against. And something I said last week, I think, is that I think you can't really look at one story or one piece and get a sense of the effect, but just what the whole thrust of the coverage is over the years. And there was a story, I was looking back, just doing a search in the Times archives, and Dennis Overby wrote a story not too long ago. I think it was after a session that was out here at Kavli, maybe, and it was about the... It was looking at superstring theory and to what degree it had paid off and what the problems are. But, you know, just a very balanced thing, you know, and it was written with kind of the assumed tone that, well, yeah, you know, this is hard stuff. This is science, and here's kind of a, you know, where we are now. And I found a story that Key Davidson had done. This was in the San Francisco Chronicle, and this was pegged to these two books. And yet the story itself is not at all, you know, promoting the point of view of the books. It's just kind of using them as an occasion to revisit superstring theory, and, you know, so you can tell your editor, why write about this now? And then it just kind of, you know, lays out the arguments, including these, you know, very same arguments that Brian Greene does. And I think, you know, in a quite balanced way, and there's probably a lot of people who read the San Francisco Chronicle that would read the story and know a lot more than they did before, and would probably react to it and say, well, you know, I certainly don't know what's right or wrong, but it's kind of interesting. I mean, it's exciting that this is all up in the air. And
so much of what has been said really seems to focus on not believing in the public's ability to understand science as a controversial, evolving thing. And certainly anyone who's taught undergraduate non-science majors would know that the first and perhaps only thing one should strive to teach them is that science is based in debate and, and controversy. And having in the public eye, even if it's not perfect in its arguments, a book which focuses on a controversy in a major field in science, I think is useful in educating the public as to what science actually is, so that they're not surprised and so that politicians can't twist the whole issue of climate change and use the inherent uncertainties and debates of science against the truth.
Yeah.
And I think it is useful to educate people at the level of science is not a headline, as you've been saying, in a short article. Not everything is known, not everything will be revealed in the next 5 minutes. It is controversial. And look, here is another controversy. It's important enough that many smart people are debating.
Right, I agree with you.
I would say that's very valid. The understanding that I think is a problem is that the way that these two books present the so-called controversy is extraordinarily one-sided and two-faced, and other problems with it as well. So it's not like either of these individuals is actually in any sense a fair arbiter of the entire discussion. So, for example, we don't see many critiques, which a number of the people in the room could actually really do well at, of the approaches that Lee works on, for example. He doesn't actually apply the same standard of criticism to the stuff that he works on as what we work on.
Yes, but, I mean, the option is there for you to write a book that refutes every argument in this book or to get on the
People have suggested that I do that.
Okay. It really has so little merit, just ignore it and it will fall by the wayside.
We hoped it would.
The answer.
We had hoped it would.
Do you need higher dimensions to be one-sided and two-faced?
Between this debate and, for example, climate change. So let me just draw this out. To a first approximation, I think most people in this room really don't care much about Peter Boyd's book and basically expect it to go away. And one of the things which concerns about Lee Smolin's book is that, as has been said many times,
I think the Swollen string discussion is seen by most string theorists here anyway as a very partisan discussion. Lee has his own theory of quantum gravity and so forth. And yet, at least in many of the reviews of his book I've seen in the media, he often seems to be portrayed as a nonpartisan figure, sometimes as an ex-string theorist, if not just general defender of the four, looking out for the four trample theories everywhere. And as far as I know, the reason I'm bringing this up now in this context is that, although I can't remember quotes and headlines and bylines and so forth, I feel like I've seen the same kind of issue arise in some of these climate change discussions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, person X will have some study who might, for example, find that there's no evidence for climate change, but maybe they're funded by a large petroleum company. Perhaps they were, in fact, quoted in some presidential report, for example, and their funding wasn't mentioned there, but then they're quoted in the New York Times or someplace else. And I feel like, in general, there may not be enough of this worrying about the politics in scientific discussions in the public.
Yeah,
this
just
may be an example of a larger phenomenon.
Yeah, and it's a lot of times you don't have the context, or like you said, a lot of environmental stories where
sometimes it can be very subtle.
Yeah,
who knows what this person's allegiance is or whatever. But in this context, it's a little bit more cut and dry. It's a little bit more obvious. I'm surprised I haven't seen more reporting of the politics involved, or at least just saying it's a partisan conflict.
Yeah, describing some of the context through which in which Smolin wrote the book.
Angle and about the
it's a good point.
Institute itself that I think is coupled to what Don was talking
about. Oh, what is that?
At any rate, there's a long backstory to this, which explains perhaps why some of us may appear to be going off on a hair trigger with this recent kind of reviews.
Oh, right? What's the backstory?
you may perhaps, I'm not sure whether people, perhaps including you, perhaps there exists at least one journalist who thinks this way, I don't know. They look at us and they say, well, we're just, really blowing up way too much.
It's all the intellectual marketplace of ideas, and there's always,
But, there is a long, long backstory to these criticisms of string theory. Which
maybe tell me later so it's not on the web.
I'm not going to it now. I'm just saying that there's a backstory to this.
I want to hear it.
Which informs the...
Yes. Yes, Jim.
It's clear, as Don said, that there are a lot of people that are upset with this book and feel damaged by it. Mm-hmm. So what are your recommendations for the tactics they should pursue to advance their cause?
Yeah. Well, I mean, getting Brian Greene on an op-ed piece, in the Times is certainly the kind of thing, to do, and just kind of to get the message out. And talking to Steve Schechter and Amanda Pete the other day, and they were wondering, well, what if we had our own blog or our own website, something that would just be, a place for the public to go to and get, objective information, links to papers, links to good articles and summaries and popular, summaries aimed for the general public and things like that. And then, not doing it as in defense, because, there's no reason. Yeah, maybe so.
Originally, my attitude, maybe I made a mistake, but I was asked to review a lot of those books. And I just didn't have the stomach to do it. And I thought one would ignore, by and large. And, that's probably the best. I'll give you an example of something that outraged the scientific community and got an enormous amount of publicity, but disappeared very rapidly because, by and large, it was ignored, and that was John Horgan.
Mm.
You remember, about 10 years ago, he wrote a book saying, The End of Science, which I think is a subtitle for one of the books we're discussing, or at least one of the implications.
Yeah. End of Physics.
Both authors worry about is string theory, the end of physics, or the destruction of physics. But anyway, Horgan claimed, you remember, that science was over, answered all the big questions, there was nothing more to do, not just physics.
It was all now just postmodern commentaries on commentaries.
And that book got a similar amount of initial press coverage. It was featured in Time magazine, and there was a bit of a lot of scientists, not just physicists, were really upset by this. And by and large, it disappeared. I mean, it was such manifest nonsense. and the right policy was really to ignore it as far as I could tell.
Well, yeah, you wouldn't want to, you know, oh, no, what? Science is not over. You know, science lives website. Yeah, right. You don't want to.
At that time, I was in Princeton with a bunch of people in Princeton who wanted to do something about it.
Let it be a peer.
They got Jerry Ostreicher to appear together with Michael, the guy, the science writer for the Times, who had made such a big deal about
organizing. Yeah, Mike Leminick at Time.
Mike Leminick. And they appeared on the Charlie Rose Show, and Jerry was fantastic because Charlie Rose. And so Michael Leminick introduces the subject. Morgan says science is over. And Charlie Rose called Prince Jerry. And Jerry says, well, what do you think? He said, well, you know, this is absurd. None of my friends think it's even worth discussing. And so Charlie Rose says, well, why did you come to the show? He said, well, it's always nice to come to New York and have dinner with some friends.
That's wonderful.
And so he spent the rest of the time trying to get Jerry to, you know, and Jerry just
couldn't take the bait.
Best attitude possible.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, to some extent, that was my, still is my attitude towards a lot of these criticisms, which are enormous. I mean, some they're slightly dishonest. Some of them are ad hominem. Mm-hmm. And the ones that are correct are, you know, the ones that are of issue, that are being discussed within our community, that it's really not the right forum or the right set of antagonists to start to discuss issues of, you know, the problems we face in at the current stage of string theory. So I still think the right attitude is not to to engage in this kind of blog war with the supreme bloggist, anyway, or public debate with marginal figures.
Hmm.
It's not the way to discuss seriously important issues.
It's allowing someone else to set the agenda.
Yeah, I mean, it's like having a serious discussion of top scientists with John Borgen about whether science is over at the end of the 20th century. It's absurd.
Joe?
Do you feel that scientists underestimate influence of articles in the New York Times for funding? Because that's why in part they talk to journalists, right? They want to influence.
Yeah. Well, I guess some of them do. I don't think, I think most of the scientists I talk to do it for much more salutary reasons. One, to make sure that what gets published is correct, and because they really believe, really excited about what they do and want to share it with the, you know, with the public. But I don't know. I don't think it. I don't think certainly not any one particular story probably has next to no effect at all. I mean, maybe the tone of coverage over time might. But you know, people like at NSF, you know, have a lot input from a lot more places than the Tuesday Science section of the Times. So I think it'd be probably really easy to overestimate that. Yeah. So is there anything else? It's been about an hour, which I think is always should be the longest thing, any longest time anything lasts, including movies. So thank you all for coming.